live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. We have a lot to share. We're going to start with health and nutrition, talk about how higher vitamin A intake is linked to a lower skin cancer risk. This is from Brown University. We have about 12 other important studies, and we have so many new listeners and viewers. We always select information that can empower you. That's the key on all levels. And about health and nutrition, we always try to cite the peer-reviewed literature, major institutions, so it's not my opinion I'm sharing. Good quality science. And these are not stories you're going to see in the mainstream media. And we do our homework, so you're going to get that every day. Also today, we're trying to expand our awareness of how our government has been substantially captured and controlled by special interest groups, not just wealthy people, you know, billionaire class, oligarchs, but also different trade groups, different manufacturers in all sectors, banking and, let's say, medicine and food. And then you have the think tanks that they fund to send forth so-called experts who then appear on nightly television programs telling you, yes, you know, Assad in Syria represents a clear and present danger to his own citizens, and therefore we must intervene. No, it wasn't true. Weapons of mass destruction was not true. Dominoes falling in Southeast Asia and clear up to San Francisco if we didn't stop the Ho Chi Minh and the people coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, North Viet Cong, the Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. We lost 58,000 people, plus over 3 million civilians in Vietnam. One lie after another by all these experts, and it's always the same. They use the same playbook and seem to succeed at it. Getting rid of Gaddafi in Libya was not necessary. He represented a threat. Not only did he not represent a threat, he represented a very stabilizing force in the African Union. He was its most respected member, and Libya was its most prosperous, highly educated, longest-lived people in Africa were the Libyans. Now it's a complete disaster zone. No one's ever held accountable. So we're here to hold people accountable, to tell you the truth, and today we're going to show you how the entire Trump was a Russian agent was a lie, and now it's getting down to where people are actually going to be indicted. In fact, just yesterday, the Inspector General of the Justice Department recommended to the Attorney General to bring charges up against Comey, the former director of the FBI, for multiple crimes that he committed, that other citizens would go to jail and have gone to jail for, yet he was given a pass. This is the double standard that we live in today. If you're rich and powerful, and if you're in the body politic of Washington, if you're in that giant group of people down there that work together, know each other, and they don't really care whether you're Democrat or Republican, it's irrelevant. You're going to prosper and you're going to be protected. So that's what we go after. We're going to do a little bit of all that on today's program. And I'm going to take a call or two from the audience. Now let's go to the latest on health and healing. According to the study from Brown University, people whose diets include high levels of vitamin A have a 17% reduction in the risk of getting the second most common type of skin cancer as compared to those who ate modest amounts of foods and supplemented their diet. That's according to the latest findings. And the cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma is the second most common type of skin cancer. And by the way, it's very common in baby boomers, my group of people that I grew up with, and that's because earlier in life, all of us were out in the sun. We generally didn't use sunscreen, and we didn't take vitamin C and other antioxidants. We didn't even know about that, that could protect us. So we got tanned, and we thought, that's nice. Today, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we're seeing squamous cell cancer in a lot of people and some more serious ones like melanoma. And that's why I suggest that you have two examinations per year with a dermatologist who will go over your skin on the back of your neck, on your hands, your arms, your face, the parts of your body, and the legs that are exposed, because it might take 30 to 40 years before they manifest. So do it for your own good. Also, from the University of Birmingham comes a study about feverfew, F-E-V-E-R-F-E-W. It's a flower, and it's been shown to kill cancer cells. According to this study, researchers at the University of Birmingham have shown that it's possible to produce a compound with anti-cancer properties directly from feverfew, a common flowering garden plant. The team was able to extract the compound from the flowers and modify it so it could be used to kill chronic lymphocytic leukemia cells. And that was in the laboratory. So that's very good. Another natural product that has anti-cancer properties. And we're going to share those all day long. Also, from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, a highly respected scientific body, they've shown that stress in cervical cancer patients is associated with a higher risk of cancer-specific death. So the bottom line is this. Psychological stress was associated with a high risk of cancer-specific death in women diagnosed with cervical cancer. And this was published in Cancer Research, a journal of the American Association for Cancer Research. But now, wouldn't it also apply to almost everything else? Stress has been shown in scientific studies to increase your risk of a heart attack and stroke. Stress can increase your blood pressure. Because stress in itself, and stress can be due to depression, anxiety, seasonal-adjusted stress, work-adjusted stress, stress in relationships, all of this does one thing. It raises a group of hormones in the body, not the least of which is cortisol. Now, we need cortisol. Cortisol is very important because it's the flight or fight hormone. It allows us to suddenly have strength and energy and increases our acuity of sound and taste and smell. That's why if you're sleeping and suddenly you hear an unusual, you know, sound at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're wide awake and you're ready to fight or flee. But what happens is that's supposed to last about a minute, minute and a half. And I've seen a lot of athletes who are all pumped, and you're right there, the beginning line, and the gun goes off, and you see their bodies tense, and they go flying out. And then about a mile later, they start slowing down. You start to see their arms coming up because they're tired. They've burned out. They were running on adrenaline and cortisol. Because when you raise your cortisol level, you automatically raise your adrenaline level. So they're burnt out. In fact, I remember in one of the first races I did, I went out like a bullet and then got slower and slower and slower. My legs ached and I was tired and exhausted and I didn't do well. And then I realized why. And then I studied the biochemistry of stress hormones. And so I did something completely different. The next race, I did a meditation and just was relaxed. And I thought about doing the race as I would do on normally my morning run. I would do it in a relaxed state, being mindful, listening to the birds and the sounds. And from that day till today, I run and race relaxed. In fact, this is just kind of a little aside, I teach the people in our running and walking club, and we've had almost 30,000 do the New York City Marathon. And some of the greatest athletes in the world, we have started. Sam Skinner, Thelma Wilson, Queedy Thompson, Louise Nottis, the greatest senior athlete in history, and Sid Howard. And we do it holistically. So meaning we work on our emotions. And we say, don't run out in front. I go out dead last. If you ever saw me in a race, you'd think, man, Gary's not in this race. There might be 100 people in a race and I'll be dead last going out because I'm allowing my body to ease into the race, my breathing, my pulse, my energy. I'm controlling it. And then I'm paying attention. Never race anyone else's race. And a lot of them are racing with their ego. And so I just watch. And so at the end of the first lap, they're way ahead. Then I just get a little faster. I do what's called negative splits, meaning each lap or each mile, I'll go maybe 15 seconds faster than the next mile, 15 seconds faster. So what I lost at the beginning by going out slow and being relaxed and getting my breathing, my rhythm, and oxygenation, I make up for it. Now you got a mile to go and I can kick and kick it into high gear, super drive. The other people they can't go any faster. They burned out. Their muscles are filled with lactic acid, which gives you that burn, and I'm not. So they're a lot better athletes, a lot faster athletes, but I've won every race I've been in for 40 years, over 500 races. And not because I'm better, I am not, but simply I'm using a different technique. And the key is in anything you do, don't do what everyone else does and expect to have a better outcome. Do something that makes yourself unique in what you do. I call it thought differentiation, meaning thinking differently about how to solve a problem, but do it differently. This morning, a gentleman came in. By the way, please never come in the office unless you have an appointment. The gentleman did not have an appointment, just showed up. But I figured he had to come from somewhere and probably took an effort. And hey, he was a senior citizen, so I sat and I worked with him almost for an hour before the show. And turns out he's a medical doctor, board certified, highly respected in his field, but he's a place in life where he's got a lot of problems. So I went over what I felt were the primary cause of those problems and the solutions. And he left now with a whole protocol. Hopefully he uses that protocol. We'll see in time. I asked him to communicate with me at the end of October. But the protocol I gave him was completely, radically different than anything he expected. But he got it. He finally got it. So in your own life, if you find that things are going well, good. But also, don't go faster than what you can think. Someone called yesterday, very smart person, has a good idea, but was going a mile a minute and talking faster than laying the idea out. And I said, if you want anyone to understand you, slow it down. Put it into proper context. Then share part of your story that people will be aware of and open to. Generally speaking, I suggest in most cases only share one piece of a puzzle at a time. Be patient and realize that it might take a year, 2 years, 5 years before all the pieces come together. If you try to give everyone, this is the answer, it's not going to work. Because no answer I can give you or anyone else can give you is going to displace what you already have as your truth. So you're going to have this duality, a new set of facts and insights and inspiration, but holding on and fighting back are your epigenetic conditioned beliefs, and no two energies are going to share that space equally. So your dominant energy, if your dominant energy is pain, fear, victimization, anger, rage, resentment, envy, greed, then that is your dominant energy, and it will collapse all the positive energy that you want to use. So you have to know, how do I surrender the dominant energy if the dominant energy is negative? And in fact, the people coming this Sunday to the workshop, two workshops. By the way, we cut the people in half who signed up originally because they did not confirm. So as of right now, I'm doing two workshops starting at 1 o'clock. One is on diabetes, arthritis, insomnia, and fatigue. That's one group. Immediately following that will be, at 3 o'clock, will be a group on depression, loneliness, sadness, insecurity, loss of motivation or purpose in life. Two completely separate groups. But that's also where I go into depth on how to get where you need to be by living an authentic life rather than continuing to master the life that's gotten you where you're at, but has not honored the authentic needs. You know, it's just something I was thinking about when it comes to stress, and stress kills you. But when you're relaxed into being. To give you one little example. Now, I don't know, maybe you've seen this for yourself, and if you have, good. If not, the next time you see Singing in the Rain with Debbie Reynolds and Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, watch this, because I watch things on an energy level. Gene Kelly's an outstanding dancer, but he's working it. You know he's trying to dance. And in every scene where Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly are dancing together, and there are several, Donald O'Connor is the better dancer because he's more fluid, relaxed. He's at ease. He's not working it. He's enjoying it. Now watch Ginger Rogers. Really good dancer. Not a good personality, but a really good dancer. She didn't have the it factor. Now, she can dance, but when you watch, if you watch the feet, Fred Astaire is frequently doing two steps to each one of hers. But the director directed it in such a way that you're paying attention to their rhythm together, not that particular way of stepping. Now watch Fred Astaire dance with his other partners throughout his career. And a really good dancer, because she had wonderful rhythm and she had one of the most vivacious personalities, was Rita Hayworth. She had the it factor. And so you just love watching her because she loved doing what she was doing, and she had that. Cary Grant had the it factor. And so I mentioned the other day who I thought the best female dancer in history was. When you watch her, and watch her and Fred Astaire, and begin the beginning, they were dancing in perfect rhythm. Astaire was not dancing faster than her. Nobody could dance as fast as her, not Ann Miller, none of them. So just a simple thought about the difference of when you're doing something with ease, racing with ease. In fact, if you see our club, when we're out there racing in a race, we're having fun. We're talking. We're having fun. We're not real intense and, you know, got to win, got to win, got to win. The winning is irrelevant. If you do, fine. Doesn't change your life. Doesn't change who you are. But if you don't, and you have fun with it, that's what counts. So are you living a life like Fred Astaire danced, smooth? Or is it just irky-jerky bumps and, you know, and a rocky ride? Do you have to buckle up for everything? Well, if you're Betty Davis, around by Betty Davis, or some of the people who didn't have the it factor, but boy, they had an attitude factor. Yeah, I guess you're going to have to buckle up if you want to be in their life. But why should we buckle up to be in someone's life? Why should we have relationships where they're contentious, argumentative? No, you got to, if your relationship isn't in harmony, what the hell is the purpose of it? Except for guilt and shame of sticking in something to prove that you can stick into something instead of being where you should be. Anyhow, a lot of stuff's going to be discussed in this upcoming series of four programs. This is a clinical study. This is the serious stuff where we're going to show that lifestyle and behavior alone can make an enormous impact on a person's health outcome. All right? By the way, that number is 646-926-5459. You'll speak with Travis. If you haven't called in and you haven't confirmed, you're out. You had your chance. I've given you about four warnings, because otherwise, here's what happened. I have limited space, and I have limited number of people I can have in this particular study. So people call, yeah, I want to be in it, and then they don't show up. How many people? As high as 50% of the people who call and say they want to do something never show up. So I'm glad that we're full on all of our things, but it's because we're realizing a lot of people aren't going to show. Finally, olive oil research takes aim at preventing Alzheimer's disease. This is Auburn University. Auburn University at their Harrison School of Pharmacy have found olive oil could be used as a preventative for Alzheimer's disease, the school reports. That's very positive, because olive oil is easy. It has a lot of anti-inflammatory properties. And so they worked 12 years on this, and they found the natural phenolic compound, oleocanthal, from extra virgin organic olive oil, enhances the repair mechanisms of the blood-brain barrier. So that's good. And turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C, treats chronic scalp psoriasis, Azad University in Iran. Turmeric, yeah. The flowering plant native to Southeast Asia, bright yellow color, adds vibrancy to dishes. Turmeric is also used in Ayurvedic medicine as a treatment for various ailments. And speaking about Ayurvedic, New York State is one of the states that allows and recognizes not just MDs, but also ODs and doctors of osteopathic medicine. But I'm going to be sharing some insights of how you could get yourself vaccinated with in a different way on an upcoming program based upon naturopathic physicians, board-certified naturopathics. But that's for another discussion. And from the Lejeune Technical College, mulberries, M-U-L-B-E-R-R-Y, for managing symptoms of diabetes mellitus. And that's important. So mulberries, I believe in having mulberries every day. This was published in the American Journal of Chinese Medicine. So that's the latest in health and nutrition. I'm going to one last one. And this is from the University of Putra, Malaysia. And it showed about how natural food can put chemotherapy to shame. And it also improves your overall well-being. And this was published in Molecular and Cellular Biochemistry. And it is based upon a noni, N-O-N-I, Morinda citrifolia is its technical name, M-O-R-I-N-D-A-C-I-T-I-R-I-F-O-L-A, or noni, N-O-N-I. The noni leaves are extremely therapeutic. Now, people know the noni juice, which is good, but it helps suppress metastasized lung cancer in an animal model. I think that's very good. I'm Gary Nall. We are 22 minutes into our program, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to your calls. Just two quick program announcements. Now that I'm back in New York City, and you can watch this program by going to Progressive Radio Network Facebook, just in the last 6 days I've been back, I've gone and supported and spoke at four different locations for vaccines, 5G technology, and why I'm opposed to it, why we all should be, et cetera. Well, there's one more, and that's tonight at 6 o'clock at Union Square. A group of parents with vaccine-injured children are coming not to demonstrate as a protest. That's not what they're doing. They're not coming to, you know, storm any hearing, but rather they're coming to educate New Yorkers about what they should do to educate on the causes of diseases in children today, the causes of damage to children who've been vaccinated, and the truth about what's actually in vaccines and the science that says that vaccines are safe and effective, and they say, no, they're not. Now, mind you, these are all, I think there's 70 of them, they're all parents who believed in vaccination, allowed their children to be vaccinated, and the children, some died, others end up with autism and other conditions. So if we are true to the concept of my body, my choice, shouldn't we also respect all of these parents? And by the way, you're talking about millions of adults who had children who are injured. Shouldn't we respect what they observed, including some are lawyers, judges, medical doctors? So you have some of the highest educated people in the United States, the professional class, who are also victims because their own children were victimized. And then they did their homework after the fact. And they're there to help other people understand Do your homework. What you choose to do is your business. That's your freedom of choice. But at least know the truth. You're not getting the truth from the New York Times. You're not getting it from CNN. You're not getting it from the doctors on television. You're not getting it from the journalists, because they're all captured at some level and hence biased in major level to say that if you're opposed to vaccines for any reason, you're the problem, instead of, no, I'm not the problem. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? Before going to a break, I'm going to ask Jesse. Jesse, let's go to a clip. This is a short clip. This is a clip of a father who worked for Merck as a top scientist in vaccines for years. And you're hearing something rare, a person from inside the establishment telling you about what goes on inside the establishment and why he chose not to vaccinate. Short clip, please listen.
Moment you've all been waiting for. The Merck insider that was about to have his own children looked into the science of vaccines while he worked at one of the biggest.
Famotidine, Prilosec, Omeprazole. Merck manufactures quite a few vaccines. Most well known is probably the MMR. Before my wife became pregnant with our first child, I was largely indifferent towards vaccines. I just assumed that it was okay. I didn't really think about it. So when Stephanie became pregnant early 2000, I had just recently started in the vaccine sterile quality operations business unit as a supervisor in the biochemistry laboratory. I began to attend vaccine policy meetings. I asked basic questions about, for instance, the Hep B vaccine. I've got a child coming in a couple of months. So I'm wondering about the wisdom, scientific and otherwise, about administering a Hep B vaccine to an infant. Virtually every medical scholar acknowledges that the immune and autoimmune system of an infant is nowhere near developed. And so this is a medical intervention to boost an immune system about which we know very little. My questions are very specific. How do we know vaccines are safe? What do we do to determine their safety? What have we done to determine the robustness of the methods that we're employing to determine safety and efficacy? These are basic questions. What I began to find is that the type of studies were kind of shabby. I felt they were kind of rushed. There was sort of a rush to market. I raised questions like that and didn't feel that they were particularly appreciated. What I'm suggesting is that while I was at Merck, the answers that come back are superficial. And that's usually code for I don't know. That doesn't line up then with the conviction and the passion that vaccines are absolutely bulletproof and everybody should be vaccinated. There's a disconnect there. Makes you wonder what else is going on. Right around when my wife was about 7 months pregnant, it was one of those moments where we're driving down a road and I'm sharing with her the concerns that I began to have. And eventually we just kind of looked at each other and knew that we had come to the same conclusion. The probability of disease actually from vaccination was actually higher. And we made a decision when we weren't going to vaccinate any of our children. We were meeting more and more individuals in the pharmaceutical business. We're also leaning in the same direction. I had a dear friend who still works in Big Pharma. She was about to give birth herself. She made that decision as well, not vaccinate at all. And we have not vaccinated a single time for any of our four children. They are super healthy, and it's, 18 years after the fact and never look back.
Okay, that's just one person, but it's important because he's coming from inside Merck. He's in the belly of the beast. And when you consider how many dangerous vaccines are out there, how many problems Merck has had, how many lawsuits they've settled that the public's not even aware of, then you start to say, wow. Then we haven't been given the full truth. And the answer is you're not going to be given the truth by your pharmacist or your doctor. One more piece, one more short clip. It's a longer clip. It's, I think, 22 minutes. We're going to play you 3 minutes of it now. This is a medical doctor and pharmacist, both, and his testimony about vaccines.
My daughter is 21, and then I have twin boys that are 19.
Okay, so when going First of all, in both you and your husband's training, when you, you know, pharmacy school and medical school, did you guys ever get any training on the dangers of vaccines?
No.
None.
Not even as a pharmacist. Mm-hmm.
So what were you, did you question the vaccines? Because you used to administer
vaccines. No, because I've never administered a vaccine. No. No, I never questioned it because we were in the medical field and, you know, we wanted to be right on schedule. We tried to do everything exactly right through the whole pregnancy and then whenever they were born, going through the vaccine schedule. I mean, whenever it was time, I was at the doctor, you know. Never thought anything about it. That's just what you did. You
and
know, we're trying to be a great, a good parent, and that's what you did.
And your husband was the same?
Yeah. We just thought we were doing the right thing.
All right, so when did you see the first injury?
I noticed it whenever I was pregnant with the twins already. And so my daughter had already been vaccinated, and I'd taken her to the beach, and she was about 15 months old, I guess. And I noticed that she was covering up her ears and her language. She used to, you could understand everything except maybe one or two words. And then it got to where it was the opposite. You could only understand one or two words. And we didn't know what was going on. So then we started speech therapy for them. Did that for a year. This whole time we had no clue it had any connection to the vaccine. So in the meantime, I have the twins, you know, going along, still having her tested different places, trying to figure out what's going on. So when the boys came along, we just started doing their vaccines, just right on schedule, just like they were supposed to be. Because we still had no idea that that was any connection at all. So when the boys had their MMR, they had an adverse reaction to it. I noticed that they were crying and had a high fever and all at night. And so my husband, he said, well, just take them over to the immediate care. So I did, took them over there. They said, no, they have the flu. And I said, no, you don't understand. They just had their vaccines like 2 days ago and they've been running a high fever and they've been crying all night. And I said, oh, well, that's just typical. And I said, well, I know, you know, that yes, they can run a low grade fever, but not like they're doing. And, anyway, they told me they had the flu and sent us home. So,
do you remember what vaccines you actually gave the boys then?
That day? I think it was their MMR. And we went, then the boys, I started noticing one day that they just weren't responding to me. And I went behind, one of them was talking, and they just didn't turn around. And I got behind them and I clapped and no response. And I got some pot lids and banged those and no response. So, I took him to the pediatrician. She sent us over to the ENT. They did an audiogram on him. One of the twins had lost all of his hearing.
It's okay.
And one of them had lost a part of his hearing. So then they sent us over to another hospital, and they did an evoked response test to see if it was the auditory nerve that had been damaged. And it wasn't that. And so they told us, well, that maybe their hearing would come back. So the boy that had lost all of his hearing, his finally did come back in 3 months. My twin that lost partial hearing, his didn't come back. He still has a partial hearing loss. Anyway, so that's when we started figuring out, okay, something's going on here, you know, that has made them lose their hearing. They're acting different. They started being just not like our children, you know. They were just totally different.
Okay, please understand that you've got a couple, medical doctors and pharmacists. This happened to their children. Everyone who participated looking at their children was in denial that it was the vaccines. They would later find out it was the vaccines, but now they've got damaged children for the rest of those children's lives. Why don't they count? Why does the media condemn them? Why isn't their right to have their choice over their child's body the same as any other person or any other woman? This is part of the contradiction and hypocrisy within the communities today. and that's unfortunate. Anyhow, I'm going to be there to give support to all those parents at 6 o'clock today, so if you're able, come by, because I'm going to do a different type of lecture. I'm going to film it. I have my film crew there, because I think we have to understand what it means to have this happen in a society that's not willing to acknowledge your pain, your suffering, and take no responsibility for it. So it's a different type of demonstration. I'm also going to give them some of the tools they need. Now, right now, anyone in this audience, we need to start pushing back with information and facts about how we've been betrayed, whether it's 5G or GMOs, you know, or vaccines. And in that regard, this morning we wrote Tucker Carlson a letter. Now, Tucker and I share completely different views on global warming. And in the process, we included, and I'm not sure how many, I'm going to ask Sharon, our archivist, who's been here for like 30 years, Sharon, to let me know how many articles I've written in the last year on the environment. I've written so many articles this year. We're writing 1 to 2 a week. These are serious articles, fully referenced. You could use these in a court of law. They're vetted by our legal team here, vetted by the scholars. But we're sending all of our articles on the environment and why it's real. And he's eaten that fruit of global denialism. And also all of the articles on vaccines and all the articles challenging Wikipedia. All told, there's over 100 articles there. And we have the letter up there. Now, I don't know Tucker. I've never met him, never spoken with him, nor is my producer. But I'll bet someone in this audience knows how to get all this to Tucker. Never underestimate the number of people and their contacts in an audience. So let's all take the letter and get it to Tucker, all right? Because in that letter is over 100 articles he's never read or not aware of, and truths that he's unaware of, and hopefully he could change his mind. He has the second largest audience. And by the way, I predict he'll pass Sean Hannity as the largest audience on cable television in the next year because he's fearless. I disagree with him probably half the things he does, but I agree with him on others, and he has the courage to debate and have people on his show. Let's get this to him. Also today, we are sending every member of Congress a letter about taking away the legal protections that have existed so that Facebook and Google and Wikipedia can't be sued. If they do something that would be illegal or unethical and therefore actionable in the regular course of business like everyone else, then hold them accountable. They have lied. They've deceived what they've done. They want more power over everyone, and they're thumbing their nose at people because, oh, you can't sue them. Congress can rescind that, as just Congress could rescind the vaccine manufacturers' indemnification from 1986. We're going to push on each of these issues. The letter to legislators is posted on progressiveradionetwork.com. Send it to your legislator. Now, a legislator will only respond to someone from their district or from their state. So send the letter, because it's applicable to every member of Congress, okay? And this is to say, this is a separate issue. This is, we want to go after Facebook, Google, and Wikipedia by taking away their protection when they've slandered, libeled, hurt someone, destroyed their reputation with malice. They know what they're doing. Don't let them get away with it. This is one way that we can stop them from their aggression. And separately, let's get Tucker all these articles, all right? And so don't wait on someone else to do it. You do it. And for a lot of you, I'll see you this evening at 6 o'clock at Union Square. You'll see there'll be a bunch of people there. So those are two important things. Now I'm going to ask, I just found this out this morning. I'm asking Val to come in studio for a moment because we have some new information about how safe is it to swim in the Gulf of Mexico or in some other bodies of water. And Val and I have been working together on these films for decades and decades, and she has been working for a long time. We've been filming this for over 7 years. We're done. She's in the final moments. We're hoping to have this ready for release in the next month or two, certainly by the fall. Hi, Val.
Hi, Gary.
Val, tell the audience what you showed me this morning.
All right.
Well, it's going to be in the new film. You just put it in this morning.
Right. The section I'm working on right now, which is about the red tide and the death of all those sea life in Delaware and Maryland, and the particular area we were talking about is the flesh-eating bacteria that's showing up all over the country. And that's the Vibrio vinificus, and it affects about 80,000 people a year, and 100 people die from it. And it's showing up in Delaware, Maryland, the Carolinas, Texas, Louisiana, Florida. It's just showing up everywhere. It's getting worse. And it thrives in warmer, brackish water, which is what we're seeing as a result of climate change. In this documentary, Tomorrowland, is about the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth caused by the Anthropocene, caused by man, and what we're doing, and that's what we're looking at. And so we are going into just one little element here. And in one of the things, one of the places that they found this in, besides these water, they found it in tar balls along the riverbanks in Tennessee. Because this bacteria loves to eat oil. So in the Gulf of Mexico, you go back to the British Petroleum deep water oil spill. There's plenty and plenty of oil that this bacteria has been feeding on and growing on and starting to
And mutating.
Hmm?
Mutating.
Yeah, and mutating, absolutely.
So here's the bottom line. When the first case of a gentleman who got this flesh-eating bacteria in Louisiana. And then another person in near the Gulf over on the west coast of Florida. Then a guy in a lake, swimming in a lake in North Carolina. And now we're seeing it spreading. And we have more oil spills today than ever before. So wherever there are oil spills, you can have this bacteria, but especially in warm water. And now it's up to 80,000 infections just this last year, mm-hmm. 100 died. So we believe that this is going to be an exponentially explosive environmental disaster. And I'm not waiting for the government to inform people. We're informing people of this because this is a part of our new documentary. And we deal with everything in the world in this documentary, every environmental crisis there is. So I just wanted you to know, I wouldn't swim in the Gulf. And I run on the beach, right?
No, but you don't want to run on the beach because this is everywhere. It's not just in the water. It's in the sand.
It's in the sand, too.
Yeah, and people have come down and died that never got in the water at all.
Okay, good to know. Uh-huh. Good to know. All right, wow. I don't run barefooted in the sand because I don't want to step on a needle, you know, that could end up there. But thank you for scaring us all. Bell.
My pleasure.
Blame her. She's the final editor. I'm just out there writing it, directing it, and filming it, and then she puts it all together. So all those films you've seen, from Poverty Inc. to Deadly Deception, that's Val. She's been, wow, we've been working over 30 years together on these films. This is the most important film we've ever done. Now, we're going to go directly to our guest who's standing by. And by the way, I'll talk about the economic consequences because once this guy starts to get out, then it's like living on Love Canal. Who's going to want to do it? So this could have enormous implications for where people live and the value of that real estate. What's the purpose of living on the beach and spending astronomical amounts of money or a canal if you run a risk from red tide of swimming in the water, breathing it, or even walking on the sand from flesh-eating bacteria with 80,000 infections from last year? Now we're going over and say hello to Rob Kall. That's K-A-L-L. He's down in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He's an American journalist and founder of the progressive liberal news site Op-Ed News, which was launched in 2003. In addition to being a longtime anti-war social activist, he was ranked by a major a company that looks at Mediate as one of the top 200 print online columnists in Op-Ed News received the first Pillar Human Rights Reward for international persons of conscience, and good for him. He's also the author of The Bottom-Up Revolution and Mastering the Emerging World of connectivity. Nice to have you with us today, Rob.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Rob, we've been deeply immersed in both alternative and commercial mainstream media for a long, long time. We've witnessed enormous social, political, scientific, and cultural changes. And for those who identify themselves as either non-compromised left or progressive, we can feel our message is largely not been heard. I mean, that I'm sorry to say that. It's like shooting rubber darts into a wall of steel. George Lakoff would argue that it's the failure to emotionally frame arguments and information effectively. Nevertheless, we do see some very positive stirrings underway at the popular and grassroots level, including greater awareness about climate change and higher critical skepticism towards anything being marketed by big multinational corporations such as Monsanto and Merck and Wall Street. And local economies and local food movements in communities building in our immediate locales. So take it from there, please, and show us how, well, at least in my estimation, we should begin turning from a top-down concept where we go to the so-called experts, and they're always the people who are at the head or top of all these different companies and governmental agencies, and start looking at how often have they been wrong, and what happens when we, the people, at the bottom level of society, we take it upon ourselves to start solving our own problems without always assuming that the government is the only place to go to get resolution of issues. The forum is yours.
Okay. Well, first, what I'd like to do is define bottom-up a bit, because while most people hear about bottom-up and talk about it a little bit, not many really know the full idea of what bottom-up is. And bottom-up is a way of relating to other people and seeing the world that's inclusive and collective. Humans evolved over 7 million years to be bottom-up because they lived in small hunter-gatherer tribes where they had to take care of each other. They had to think about every decision they made in terms of how it would affect the other people in their band. And so bottom-up was the way people lived for 99.9% of human existence. And then civilization came along, which is top-down, with hierarchy and centralization, and it repressed many of the different aspects of bottom-up nature in us. Then the internet and smartphones came along, and it's kind of catalyzed the return to us being bottom-up, and it's come on really strong because of all the genetic potential to be bottom-up. And so that's where we are now. We have a top-down culture and a top-down mentality for seeing the world, at least people born before 1980. People born after 1980 who grew up at least as teenagers immersed in the internet and smartphones, their brains are different, and just about every neuroscientist will agree to that. And so we have a situation where particularly people born before 1980, they have a top-down mentality, and that includes having a kind of an authoritarian nature. Now, there are two kinds of authoritarians. There's the one who says, I'm going to tell you what to do, and this is what you need to do. And then there are the 10,000 who say, please tell me what to do. And unfortunately, that applies to liberals and progressives, too. A lot of them want to be told what to do. A number of years ago, I ran a poll working with the Zogby Company looking at health responsibility. And I was trying to get an idea of how people felt about taking self-responsibility for their health. Would they rather have a doctor say, here, take this medication, or would they rather be able to take responsibility for their health by exercising and controlling their diet, learning biofeedback, things like that? And what I was shocked to see was that people who were more liberal preferred the more top-down, tell them what to do approach. And have you had any experience or thoughts about that?
I would absolutely agree with that. I've counseled almost 70,000 people one-on-one, And my experience has been that those within the more liberal community want you to lay it out for them. And otherwise, you have people who say, give me an idea and I'll run with it. I'll create it my own. A lot of people like to be very independent in that. Let me give you an example of this. I'm holding now, and for people, this is a full page from yesterday's newspaper, and it says this, Google's polluting Echo meeting. And it talks about how Google is spending $30 million to invite a lot of famous people, a lot of celebrities, to talk about the environment, among other issues. And these are people that fully support 5G technology, support GMOs, support vaccines. And they're also going to supposedly tell us about the environment. And then I looked at Katy Perry and some of the people who are famous and good at what they do. I respect that. But I don't want Katy Perry, and I don't want any of these people who are not experts in the field or contribute anything that is original and meaningful to tell me what I should be doing. Then they start going from being a celebrity in one field to virtue shaming anyone else because you don't have an idea that's worth anything because you're not famous and you haven't been invited by Google to go to these exotic locales, all flying on private jets, all eating meat. David Geffen shows up. There's an obscene gesture in a $400 million yacht. And Barry Diller with a $200 million yacht. These are massive polluters, massive pollution. The private jets are massive pollution. And then eating the meat. And the fact that they're all now posturing as if they're rich and famous, so we should believe them. And I'm saying, I don't want to hear from any of these celebrities about what I should do, because show me the articles you've written. Show me the documentaries you've produced. Show me the books you've written. Show me what you've actually done. And then maybe I'll pay attention to you. And that's why I believe we have to start at the bottom, where people actually are impacted the most by the actions of these people, these dilettantes, these narcissists, who somehow parade around each other as if they're special because they're famous and rich. Your thoughts, please.
I think that what Google's doing is smart in terms of their strategy. They're taking influential people, top-down, big-name people, celebrities, and they're using them to sell their message. Now, that's a problem, but there's a lot of hope. And what I try to talk about in my book, Bottom Up Revolution, which you can find out about at robcall.com, is that things are changing dramatically, quickly. Now, Google made billions because they figured out how bottom up could work in their search algorithms. But the example you just gave is a clear example of how they're taking celebrities. One thing that I think is really exciting, Howard Zinn, who wrote the People's History of the United States, was one of the pioneers in bottom-up history. Now, history for most of modern humanity's existence was top-down. It was looking at generals and presidents and kings and the most powerful people, and it was a portrayal of how those people influenced the changes in the world. But with Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and scores of other books about bottom-up history, people's history of indigenous, of sports, of different cultures, of different religions, all these different kinds of bottom-up approaches to history, they do a major thing. When you start talking about how a worker or a soldier or your neighbor has contributed to history, it lets you think that you can contribute to history. When you have the top-down history and it's all governors and kings and presidents and CEOs, then you look and think, well, they're the ones who make history. But when you have a bottom-up history, then you can see your role in making history happen. I tell in the book about Daniel Ellsberger. Daniel Ellsberg, he went to a talk by an anti-war activist who was going to go to jail. And the activist told his story. He was supposed to go to jail the next day. Ellsberg listened to him and said, this guy's going to jail. I have to do something that I can do to make a difference. Now, my point in this story is you can protest, and you never know when what you do as a protester, among many, can influence or inspire someone who could make a huge difference. And Daniel Ellsberg, who was what he did was amazing, but he was catalyzed by somebody who nobody knows her name. The name is in the book, but the point is, you can make a difference. You can play a role in history. And the thing with bottom up is it applies in every aspect of our life. There are top down and there are bottom up ways of relating to people. You know, you mentioned George Lakoff. George Lakoff describes conservative families as families where there's a very strong authoritarian, where there's a strict father, and children are taught to be very obedient, whereas progressive or liberal families tend to be nurturing and supportive and to teach children to be more independent. And this whole idea of bottom-up it involves helping people to help each other and getting people to think and look at their world in a way where, how can I participate in this? How can I help the other guy? How is my decision going to affect the other people around me and nature? You know, Native Americans have a saying that where they a decision should consider how it affects the next seven generations. And I really believe that civilization cut out a lot of the wisdom that was from indigenous people, and we need to go back to that. If we're going to save our planet, we need to go back to understanding and learning from indigenous people, and there are still about 250,000 indigenous people left on the planet, and they could be the ones who teach us how to survive, really.
Well said. Rob Kall, K-A-L-L, the author of this very important new work, and is it available everywhere yet?
Yes, it is. If you go to robkall.com, R-O-B-K-A-L-L.com, there are links to it on Amazon, Powell's, local bookstores.
Oh, good.
You can get it. You can ask for it if it's not already in Barnes & Noble. They carry it as well.
And what I'd like to do is invite you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour. That's the most listened to program I do each week, every Tuesday evening, so we can explore this in greater depth. All right?
That'd be great. Love it. Thanks. And thanks for all you do. You're really contributing to getting the ideas of progressives out there in a major way. And, you know, my show is the Bottom Up Show is on Progressive Radio Network, and I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. I look forward to a next conversation, which will be very shortly, within the next week or two, on Progressive Commentary Hour. We'll have a whole hour with Rob Kall. I'm Gary Nall, everyone. Thank you for listening, and have a nice day.